Hello and welcome to the next episode of Pharmacast, the podcast from the School of Pharmacy at Queen's University Belfast. Delighted to be joined by two very special guests today on the podcast to talk about a really important topic within pharmacy and further afield within healthcare as well. So without further ado, I will say hello and welcome to Dr. Dennis O'Driscoll, who is the Superintendent Pharmacist at Lloyd's Pharmacy Ireland and has a range of expertise in the topic that we'll be talking about today. Joined also by Joanne Barry, who is no stranger to Pharmacast, who is a Senior Lecturer Education here at the School of Pharmacy as well. And teaches heavily on our pharmacy practice aspects of our courses, along with many others too. So welcome to both of you. Thanks very much for taking the time to come along and join us online for this very special podcast. So the topic of today's podcast really centers around substance abuse. And as I've mentioned already, it's a really important topic when it comes to community pharmacy healthcare more widely. And it's certainly something that has been no stranger to news articles over the last number of years and is becoming increasingly more common. Dennis, I know that your expertise on this is vast. And I think for our audience at home, it's maybe worth starting from the top on this and a little bit more generally. When we're thinking about substance abuse, I guess it'll be good to hear from you in terms of what type, what sort of drugs are we talking about when we're talking about substance abuse more generally? There may be some that those listening may automatically have spring to mind, but are there others within that are a real problem that those listening at home may not necessarily have realized in terms of when it comes to substance abuse and that problem within healthcare?
Okay, good question, Dan. So I'm going to be really mean at the very start of this and say that I find the word abuse a little bit pejorative. I prefer the word use because we have to allow the person who wants to use the drugs, we might determine it as like they're abusing them from the perspective of a pharmacological perspective. So I think from a service user's perspective, if we keep patients centered around this, I think it actually adds value to you as a pharmacist working in a community pharmacy or working within addiction services to understand where people are coming from rather than us thinking we know the answers to what or why they might be using their substances that use. Now, I myself slip then every so often to using the word abuse. I also slip into other things. So, you know, I might be all good and holy at the start of this, but as you go through the podcast, you'll notice that I slip back and forth. And I guess from my perspective, just explain why I have an experience in this is that I originally joined the addiction services with the health services here in Ireland in 1997 and worked for them up until 2018, working on a number of projects across the country, be it the rollout of a pharmacy needle exchange program and be it the rollout of an overdose prevention program with the use of naloxone, and also ensuring the movement of some people like to call it now OAT, so opioid agonist therapies across the country outside of the kind of urban areas. My perspective, I've always felt, and this is a very personal perspective around drugs that can be prone to being misused. If something alters your mind in some ways, there's always potential of being misused. Like when I joined the addiction services first, I was bemused at the fact people misusing olanzapine, for example, to get they have an effect from that by taking excess amounts of olanzapine. Like on the street, they were called lilies. We have, like when, from my perspective, when pregabalin came about, I always had a, when I saw the way it was being brought in, and when you looked at the way it works in the body, I always went, this doesn't look great. I didn't like the way that you had to taper it up and taper it down. And sure enough, it's causing more and more problems and has seemed to be coming more to the fore. I know particularly in Northern Ireland, it's been particularly problematic. The wonderful one in down with us in the Southern region, they always want the original brand. They don't like the generic brand because, as you know, the original brand is lovely red and white little capsules known as buds. So they're much preferred and much more street orientated. So I guess that's where I'm starting from, that any substance that has to alter the mind in any way has a potential for me to use it in a different way in order to elicit a different effect. I would say that if you look into the pharmacy, if anyone walks into a pharmacy, there is a plethora of substances in there that are problematic. We've had issues in the past with some of the nootropics, like Provigil, for example, has been problematic now and again. You see it prescribed, you see people looking for it. I think COVID changed the landscape completely with regards how people access their meds, particularly drugs that they want to use for recreational purposes, because they change from kind of your traditional over to your non-traditionals. And what I mean by that is your traditionals being like cannabis weed or moving over to skunk and pollens because they're much more higher intensity of THC. You know, some of the amphetamine based substances changing over to like making easier access to get certain tablets. Even some of the more interesting benzodiazepines that were coming across the market that we hadn't seen before, that were coming through. And of course, the one that everyone has a huge fear about is the whole thing with whether fentanyls and the isotretinoin will come across the borders to us and be problematic versus heroin and versus methadone. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question now. I've probably gone completely off track on you. But I think for me, it's all about me with patients, people who use drugs, it's meeting them in the place where they're at rather than me trying to bring them to somewhere else. I remember when I joined the service first, I got told that we'll only need you for 6 months and we'll have the problem solved. And that was in 97, and the problem is still there. It has increased, obviously, but more people have come forward for treatment because waiting lists have decreased. And I'm sure it's the same in the north, where if you have a waiting list, people often don't come forward for treatment because they're kind of going, what's the point? I'll be sitting on a waiting list. Whereas if you can clear waiting lists through, which happened during COVID, you find that more and more people come into the system because they know it's easier accessibility. So I think one of the major issues, our barriers, are ones we have to surmount, is to make sure that we don't put these huge barriers in people's faces in order to access treatment. And that treatment, one treatment option doesn't fit all. We need to have that toolbox where I might decide as a user that, yeah, I want to detox. And you might, as a practitioner, be kind of going, I really don't think that's a great idea for you. But that's you. Let them try it. And if they themselves are, they have the wherewithal and the understanding of their addiction to know that it's not working for them and might come back looking for help, rather than us trying to squeeze everyone to these, you know, what is it, round pegs into square holes, whatever way that's described.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that's a very good overview in terms of those types of medicines that are out there. What I found was quite interesting is a lot of the medicines that you mentioned, but it took a long time before we started thinking about things like fentanyl and opioids as well, which I think everybody's maybe listening to the podcast, maybe it's the first thing that springs to mind when it comes to it. I think on that, and that's where, you know, it really is of interest to me in terms of how does this abuse, and I've used abuse again, and I'm going to have to learn, Dennis, so apologies, I'll say use again. How does this happen, I guess, from a sort of very sort of overarching perspective, maybe in a little bit more detail? So is there any sort of trends in the pharmacology of medicines that are more problematic than others? Is there something in terms of how they're prescribed in terms of that, or is it just a real random mix?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of research around, you know, why do certain people become addicted to substances and other people, you know, don't. And there's that whole people will say, oh, I only use recreationally, I don't have a drug habit. You know, I'm not, and I hate this word, I'm not an addict like those over there. And the way I look at it is that from my perspective, the substances that, as I said, that I've always found to be the problematic ones are the ones that people use, and in order to elicit the same effect again, use more, find it very difficult to stop. And find it extremely challenging that their behaviors and other parts of their lives start to change because of their need to get the substance. And an interesting example in that kind of area, from my perspective, are your bodybuilders, your anabolic steroid users. Sure, a lot of them will state categorically, I'm not a drug user. I'm not a person who uses drugs. But yet, when you look at their use of the substances that they use multiple products. They use other drugs in order to decrease the effects of one substance over another. So an example would be, they often will take like tamoxifen or Aramidex, one of those products, in order to decrease the amount of estrogen they're producing because of the excess testosterone they're taking in. They'll also take Brumal, or, you know, they'll also take fat stacking substance to a fat burning substance, which is usually a stimulant, caffeine and ephedrine stack that they'll sometimes take. And then they find it really hard to stop, because what happens then is they stop, they lose some condition. They obviously have affected their hypothalamic axis with regards to their own internal production of testosterone. So they go into that deep depressive state. So they don't like that. So they continue to use. They sometimes use more or change their substances. So even somebody like, you know, who you wouldn't normally classically describe as a substance user, you know, like your classic heroin user or IVDU, mm-hmm. these kind of categories or subcategories also fall into that. And then you've got even the more fascinating and more kind of on the fringes, your chemsex users are similar in the sense that they're using substances in order to improve their performance or change their behaviors around their sexual encounters in order to use substances to either improve or distance themselves from what's going on in the room at the time. And you find in that kind of scenario, there's products such as, you know, your amphetamines. You'll also get ketamine regularly used. You'll also get all your other performance drugs, like your erectile drugs used for erectile dysfunction, used in excessive amounts in order to improve that performance. And again, it's kind of like a subculture within that. So for me, a lot of it comes down to where the description of when it becomes a problem is that when people start using this for a longer period of time, you know, greater than a year, and this is an ongoing issue, mm-hmm. in other parts of their lives, they find it very difficult to stop. They're using more than they intended to use at the very start, and they'll continue to increase that habit. Where addiction comes from, you could argue, does it start from, you know, nurture nature? Have they seen it in a household? Classically, the Irish population, with regards to the use of alcohol, there's always been an association with alcohol as a base drug there. Smoking, that we often like ignore. There was a very interesting study out of the Maudsley by, I'm going to get his name wrong, I think it's Professor Hill. He did a study called Smoke, which is a very interesting study around looking at people who used nicotine and comparing it to somebody who used heroin and the similarities across that spectrum. And then, of course, there's the whole thing around, you know, stressful environment of where you're at and what you need to use and trigger factors. And when I was in the addiction service, and even today when I'm in a pharmacy working with any patient who has a misuse issue, it's all about building up trust. It's also letting them come up with their plan rather than me giving them a plan. That's how I've always felt it. I've always determined as well that if there's other substances involved with their addiction, and we all know that it's not a uni substance use, it's always a multiple substance use perspective, that I try and get rid of the more challenging substances. So your sleeping tablets, your benzodiazepines, your cocaines, your cannabis. I find that if somebody's on OAT, like methadone, buprenorphine, if they have everything else gotten rid of, and this is like ideally, they're easy substances to bring down versus other substances that people tend to use. And they're much more challenging. And it's much more challenging often for patients themselves to try and come to the realization that they might have to come off all of this. And equally, you have to empower them that they have the skills that when everything is stopped, that they have the skills to make sure that they don't relapse. Or if they do relapse, that they come back into treatment as quickly as possible.
Yeah. So I think a lot of the various compounds, for want of a better expression, that you'd mentioned there maybe are not necessarily ones that those listening might associate with those that are maybe prescribed to patients and a problem from there. What size or how big do you think the problem is from a prescribed medicine perspective, where a patient maybe given a medication for a particular therapeutic need, and that then causes more of a problem, I guess, than it's solving? Is that a massive problem, particularly in the South of Ireland, or how is that looking at the minute?
I think it's hard to determine, and I don't mean to sound like I'm evading the question. I think it's much more complicated to determine that than people imagine. Mm. We definitely, during COVID, so I'll give you an example. So the whole thing with codeine, over-the-counter codeine, and the potential for misuse of over-the-counter codeine. Before COVID, people could chop around. Like, it's very hard to figure out that I'm going to Joanne's pharmacy, your pharmacy, my pharmacy. I won't know the person. So when COVID hit, obviously, there was restrictions on travel. We came across a young student who was taking up to, I think it was 150 Nurofen plus a day. And he had a schedule, and like he was a very intelligent young man. He had a schedule on how he shopped, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
He had it very much determined that he knew that if he was X amount of time not in a certain place, they wouldn't really necessarily put two and two together and think that he was shopping, because he had a space time of nearly 3 weeks between each pharmacy visit. So you as yourself as a pharmacist, you wouldn't really notice that. It would they're in again. Yeah, obviously they have a little bit of pain. They're picking up 24. The habit, obviously his habit was costing him an enormous amount of money. They're not cheap to purchase. But only because of COVID, he came forward for treatment. Now, you could argue, and this is, I've always argued the fact that I'm more concerned with the, let's say, the ibuprofen content and the fact of his damage to his stomach, kidneys, etc. He actually got admitted for stomach issues. There was a bleed. That's what he got admitted for. Right. And that's how we found out that there was other issues going on. You could, people argue that, oh, they have a huge codeine addiction. What we find is that there's also, okay, so he also, he used codeine, but there were also other substances in the background that came out in the wash over a period of time. There was a particular issue with certain amphetamines and sleeping tablets as well that came up prescribed for him. But again, his GP wasn't aware that he had shopped for the codeine product. So nobody knew that. Like, it only came together when he told his story. Other than that, this guy could have been happily doing this. And again, because of his admission for the bleed, that was discovered that was because of the non-steroidal. So the guy, he was placed on buprenorphine because it was seen as a better substance for this, you know, because he was in college and everything, just from a clarity of mind perspective. Everyone goes, oh, he must have been on, you know, what kind of dosing he was on. I think he ended up being on a relatively high dose of buprenorphine, if I remember correctly. Has he come down a little bit? He has. Will he be on it long term? I don't know. I've never asked anyone to come off any OAT until they're ready to come off it. I've never put a timeline on it. I don't agree with putting timelines on these things. But for me, the whole thing around trying to determine or looking for those trigger factors. So all of us pharmacists kind of keep an eye out for the lady coming in early for her sleeping tablet, or the gentleman coming in early for his painkillers. But we all know the amount of, and I'm sure it's the same in the north and south, the amount of Tramadol that's prescribed, like people getting excessive amounts, in my opinion, of this month after month. Like, there has to be some sort of management around that. I know in the UK, and I'm not sure if it's happened in Northern Ireland, they were looking at rescheduling that particular product. I think it's something I've asked for here on a number of occasions. We need to look at Tramadol, because if I take a urine dip test or a saliva test from a patient, with using my point of care testing, it's only ever, it will only pick up the opioid, as in like a heroin metabolite or methadone metabolite. It won't pick up tramadol metabolite. So often these tests are extremely specific. They're trying to determine if they're abusing them or not and how they're getting them. And the internet has been a huge supply chain for a lot of people, particularly for some of the prescription opioids. And like, I think that we haven't even seen what's going on out there. Like, we know that there's and I'm sure it's similar to it, like in the north, you can tell from NHS prescriptions how many people are being prescribed benzodiazepines, how long they're being prescribed them for. You can do all the ATC coding on that. In Ireland, we have a very interesting system where you have a public like NHS system and then private. So the issue there is we have no idea how many people are going public private on their prescriptions, and that's always been kind of a difficulty for us. And we have in the past rescheduled our benzodiazepines here to bring them up to CD4 part one status, which has it helped? It has helped to some extent, but my issue is then other drugs that are coming up in the background. More for me, pregabalin. Like, I know people go, it's not a benzodiazepine, but we all know it works in the GABA receptor ultimately. So quacks, walks, talks like a duck. It must be something like a duck. So, you know, that substance is still not tightly controlled here to the same extent as the benzos. So is that going to be our next one that people will start looking for, because it's much easier to access it than a benzodiazepine? Because we had huge changeover when we rescheduled, for example, Normison, when we rescheduled that was literally people stopped taking it because of the amount of effort in writing prescriptions, but they moved to other benzodiazepines.
And that's an interesting point, Dennis, in that, you know, even from my past experience as a pharmacist and around Northern Ireland as well, and Joanne, feel free to kind of comment on this as well. There have been the introduction of schemes that have, from the outset, kind of almost been, let's make it as difficult as possible to get patients these medications. In your experience, is that something that you find generally works? I know that you've said there that in some instances patients have stopped getting one particular medication, but they've maybe then gone and looked for an alternative. Is that the general trend? Do you find those sort of approaches to it are successful in any way? Is it something that really needs to be kind of married up with much more support for those patients in need?
Legislative changes definitely help. Okay. However, we just need to be mindful of what happens when legislative changes happen. So we had, if you remember, we had the wonderful experience here. I'm not sure if you had the same up in the north with the head shop products. And we brought in the Criminal Justice Act in 2015 and everything went underground. And about a year and a half later, we had a significant issue with a spike in HIV rates associated with the use of some of the bath bomb products that had been sold in head shops, some of the cathinones. So putting it underground meant then we had no idea what was coming in anymore. Yeah. When it was available, you could sample it. I'm not saying that was right either, by the way. I'm not endorsing the fact that you could access these products. But I think that the whole idea that if you legislate for something, you have to have something in place to look after those patients who are now going to find it extremely difficult to access product. And that, I'm not sure how that will be done, because at one stage here, we were looking at, you know, how to manage benzodiazepine use, how to manage excess benzodiazepine prescribing, dispensing. What worked very simply in one GP surgery was they put a sign up in their GP surgery saying, if you'd like to discuss your current sleeping tablets, please talk to your GP. And we're more than happy to talk to you about it. And it resulted, okay, it was a very small, sparkle, I like to call it, because sometimes all these little sparkles can come together and cause an explosion. It caused a reduction of up to 40% in the usage of benzodiazepines in that particular practice, just because they asked people to come talk to them about it. Because a lot of people had been maybe put on them, and I'm not saying that people are lazy and continually gave them, but they never said they wanted to stop them. So often you kind of go, oh, well, Mary's not able to come off this, or Joe, or whatever. And it was only when they came forward and said, I'd like to look at, I really don't know what benefit I'm getting from this anymore, I actually don't need it, that they then started to look at dose reduction for those particular patients. So I think you need to have something in place if you're about to change legislation that it becomes extremely inaccessible for the patient, because suddenly then they get product that maybe not, it's completely different, that we don't know what it's going to do next to them. And you suddenly end up with like a spike in A&E admissions or anything like that. And that's the whole rationale. You know, when you look at drug testing at festivals, that you're protecting people, that if you want to use drugs, okay, we like the idea that with the Nancy Reagan area of kids don't use drugs is not working. Yeah. So we need to look at the whole thing about how we can make it safe for them. And I think that's been clearly demonstrated, particularly in the UK, around the lessening of hospitalization around festival events going to drug use. And certainly in recent occasion in Ireland, particularly with last year's electric picnic, where the notification of these increased in strength MDMA substance were available, that it decreased the amount of people who take them. They might think twice and kind of go, well, actually, I won't take that now. So often it's just, we need to just be aware that we can't stop people from using drugs if people want to use them. People will experiment. But we just need to be available that they can use them in the safest possible environment for them and for their use.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Joanne, how does that marry up? Sorry, go ahead.
No, go on ahead, Dan. Yeah,
okay. I was interested because I know you're still very heavily involved in community pharmacy and working in the community. How does that experience marry up with your work in terms of patients who have maybe been receiving medications for an extended period of time, maybe haven't had those reviewed, but have said, well, look, I'm still being prescribed these, I should take them, and they're maybe the source of a wider problem? Is that something that you've found to be an issue?
Yeah, I suppose it is, Dan. And I think, people are people, so it doesn't matter where they live. It's all the same. We just probably practice in slightly different healthcare settings and legislation. And policies behind them. But I suppose in listening to Dennis, there's a couple of things I've been thinking about. One, particularly because of my community pharmacy background, is the OTC medicines and the misuse of those. So people using them just not as we intend for them to be used. And the codeine is a brilliant example about the overuse of the ibuprofen and the paracetamol that goes hand in hand. And I work in a border area, so we would have a lot of people who come from the south to purchase. So we're not only using people within their own jurisdiction buying, they're buying multiple and then they're traveling, you know, a couple of hours to buy further packs. And we have two policies of different questions that we ask to supply of codeine. And I know I've been accused of being the codeine police before. And I'm not sure that that's the answer either. I think we need to be trying to figure out why people have this pain and why they're using these products. Yeah. And have they got pain, or is it trying to get the benefits of the codeine and having to use more and more of it? And like Dennis, I've come across people who are on buprenorphine as a result of OTC codeine use or misuse, and really are... It can take a lot of confidence from the pharmacy team to really make that intervention and repeating that message. But I know one patient that really stuck out in my mind, and she comes to the pharmacy now to get her buprenorphine that she was also purchasing a high percentage of the codeine from. But it was, she claims that community pharmacy team saved her because they just kept saying to her the message, you're using too much, there's something wrong. And you know, supported her with initially making contact with her GP and then got onto a treatment program from that. So, you know, there's lots of debate about whether we should be upregulating codeine back to a POM or, you know, within the CD legislation. But is it just going to push it underground and not getting codeine that at least we know what the standard off it is? You know, there's pros and there's cons, but I think we very much need to have a plan in place about what we're going to do. You know, and we've lots of other medicines that people come into community pharmacies who we know are using them too much, you know, like our Nitols with the antihistamines, etc. in them. And you know, so there's so much, you know, medicines that have genuine use. And we need to be very careful as a profession too, that we don't assume that every person that's purchasing those medicines are purchasing them for an inappropriate use as well. So there's that bit of it. And I suppose the other bit is tramadol here has been a Schedule 3 CD for a number of years now, Dennis. And I suppose the benefit from that was, yes, prescriptions had to be written in a particular way, but it gave, you know, the... a more monitoring of how much pharmacies were buying in and seeing local issues around, you know, record keeping in terms of the invoices and that too. So yeah, it's a big issue. We also have a number of, because we've prescribing pharmacists working in our GP practices here, we've had great success with some who've really focused on benzodiazepine reduction programs, but it takes time and it takes a dedicated one-to-one relationship between the pharmacist and the patient as well. So there is great success with supporting people, but we do need to be very proactive. And I think patient education, a lot of people drift in to misuse of medicines unintentionally. You know, and when you take the time to talk to people, you know, patients I've worked with, you know, whether it be supply of methadone or in needle exchange programs, it's not always a conscious decision that this is the pathway for their life. Something else is happening and it just happens, and they have genuine pain and they genuinely need a pain reliever after their surgery. But, you know, that use just becomes a bit too much and it becomes a dependence from there. So I think we can't, there's not one answer for it all, but it's something that community pharmacy definitely deal with on an ongoing basis. And we deal with, we have to remember, all those patients also have other health conditions. So, you know, they're coming into us for perhaps, you know, harm reduction programs, opioid substitution programs, but they're also coming in with, you know, their prescriptions for maybe mental health conditions, for cardiovascular, for respiratory. And we need to support them with that. Yeah. And as are their families and their partners and their children, you know, so we're in there every day. And some pharmacists are much more experienced than others, but I think it's just having the confidence to ask people.
Yeah.
You know, just asking the patients that we're dealing with, you know, what can we do to support you? You know, is it their oral hygiene we can support them with?
Mm.
You know, you don't have to be an absolute expert in everything to do with maybe the opioids they're using or the other medicines that they're using or misusing, but we can always help them with some aspect of their health.
Yeah.
And that's a really good point. We don't need to know everything. Like when I give a talk and people say, oh, what does, you know, 4-5 fluoro XYZ do? I kind of go, the basic question here is, it a stimulant? Is it a depressant? Or is it something that's kind of on you know, in the neither here nor there category, as I like to call it, my hallucinogens and cannabis. So like I often will kind of tell people, just bring it back to the basics. You know, they're all, you just need to deal with the patient of where they're at. And as you said there, I find that I never tell patients what to do.
Yeah.
But even though as a pharmacist, that's what we do every day, because we tell patients how to take their meds. I'll order that in for you, Mrs. Jones. I'll be in later on this evening. Now, if there's an interaction there, I'll have to contact the doctor. But as you mentioned there with the needle exchange, we have tried to use that very much so as a signposting piece. Pharmacists being used as a signposter to move them into, you know, services if they want, or better still, to get vaccinated, or better still, if they to get tested for Hep C, so we get rid of, you know, so we treat Hep C. Even if they don't want to go into OAT treatment, that we at least try and signpost them elsewhere. What I found with my needle exchange patients that come into me is that I let them ask me the questions, and I try and I reflect back a lot what they say rather than giving them an answer of what I would think they'd like to do. So I try and let them come up with their care plan, and then we work with that for the next few weeks and see how we get on. And I think that's a very important point, that it's not just the individual and that issue with a substance, it's all the other things that go around that, and the families and the communities that are all interlinked.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, and something that you've mentioned a few times at the minute, Dennis, has been that opioid agonist therapy, that OAT, and you've said a few times, which is really great to hear, that you don't intentionally tell patients what to do in this perspective. And you mentioned earlier on in terms of taking that OAT and when to stop that and those sorts of things as well. I'm really intrigued in terms of how you make that decision with patients. You know, if they are on an OAT, how does that decision made about when to stop that medication, if it's worth continuing on with? You know, what sort of factors kind of feed into that decision that you make with the patient?
So normally I try... So let's say you're starting in treatment. So I go through the whole thing is that, you know, while you're starting on this, you really need to stop using other substances because we run the risk of killing you. Like, I'm very upfront and honest about methadone and the risks for the first couple of weeks of treatment. Once they're in treatment, like often I have patients who will say to me, they're in treatment and they've done really well. They're on a lovely stable dose. We know they're not topping up, but we do know they like their bit of benzo on the side, or a little bit of this on the side, a bit of coke at the weekends or whatever. They'll say, oh, I want to detox now. And I go, how long? I always start the conversation, how long were you using drugs before coming into us? And they went, oh, you can check my file. I went, I can check your file, but how long were you, you know, just, you know, can you? And so they might say 4 or 5 years. And I go, and you're here now 4 months, and you expect that all this will be treated in the next 4 to 6 weeks when I detox you. But on the other side, you have all these other substances that are more problematic in my head. And often you'll get people saying, I didn't come here for my cocaine use. I only came here for my heroin use. Thanks a million, Dennis. You're a great guy, but no thanks.
Right.
And so I always try and get them to look at, for me, the most, and Joanne already alluded to it, the most difficult substance to detox from, in my opinion, are benzodiazepines and benzodiazepine-like compounds, your Z compounds.
Yeah.
They're extremely challenging. And even when you do a detox, you're dependent on having that really strong relationship with the patient that they're not topping up, because you've no way of telling otherwise. You know, you're dependent on them being truthful and you being open and honest with them. And I think it's the being open and honest and saying, look, I don't think you're able for a detox, but if you'd like to try it, let's try it.
Mm.
So I normally would discuss with the GP, the prescriber, to say, look, Dennis wants to reduce his dose slightly. We look at it maybe for a week, see how we get on. If it's not successful, can we slowly taper him back up again? So what would happen is that we'd bring him down, and if I would say, how are you doing this week? And if they're saying, I'm struggling, I go, so do you want to come up a small bit? And if they ask for that, they get it. There's no, like, it's not like, oh, I don't know, we can't put you up. I don't put barriers in the way of them going up or down, but I try and get them to stabilize for a period of time, that I try and get them linked in with a counseling or some sort of intervention service to look at triggers, to look at how they can cope, try and engage them back with families. Let's say they've distanced themselves with families, even things like to come back into a simple education program that might be running locally, and just to bring them back into the whole idea that, you know, to kind of look at the other slices of their life. So I always describe it as a cake, and methadone is this 1/8 of that cake. There's all the 7/8 of your life that we need to look after. But if that we can stabilize that 1/8, we can all look at this, and then we can remove that 1/8, and you still can make it a full life by the fact you can push it together by removing that out. But that will take time. But we need to get rid of the other. For me, it's always getting rid of the benzodiazepines is a challenge. The kind of cocaine culture is always going to be a challenge because, you know, the slippage into that with alcohol and everything else. Yeah. Just have to keep an eye on that. When we're starting the addiction services first, when I look back now, I kind of like cringe small, but we, like, if you were smoking cannabis and stable and everything else, it was like, well, that's grand. Whereas now we have to change our ideology around cannabis because of the strength of THC. It's really a potent substance that wasn't as potent before in the past. So we now need to acknowledge it as that. So I think that it's a lot of work for the patient themselves, but they need to start. I often ask them, where would you like to start? So you'll get somebody who say, I'm taking 12. I got one guy taking about 40 to 60 Zimovane a day. Wow. And he said to me, oh, what can you give me a dose to stabilize me? And I went, the most that we'll ever give you is going to be 3. And even at that, I'm like a bit cringy about giving you 3 a day because I'm way beyond what the SMP would suggest. Mm-hmm. And we had to get him to come down to that level. And when we brought him down, we did start him on 3. But we moved him when he started moving downwards over to diazepam. And I know people go, it's not a parent compound, but it was just an easier detox from there to bring him across. So we brought him across and then tapered him down. He never went to zero. He did go to zero on a number of occasions, but always there was a relapse. So in the end, what ended up was that he was put on a 2 milligram tablet as like just a dose on a daily basis. He knows that he has to eventually tackle it. But at this moment in time, he is in a space where he's working, has his family, is back in a relationship, has his children. And for me, the 2 milligrams of diazepam, I believe that he's not topping up on it. Other people would say I'm naive, but I believe him that when he says it to me, he's not. So that's where I have to open my trust relationship there, that like I can't. As a pharmacist, we're always thinking, are they telling the truth? You're always in your head going, there's something wrong here. But I'm doing my best here to believe that he's not topping up with anymore. I have no reason to believe he is topping up anymore because I trust what he's saying. Because he's also brought his dose of methadone downwards and he wants to come off both. But we've decided that we're holding for a while because there's issues going on that he just needs to resolve before we go any further. But for me, it's been a very long road with this particular guy. So will I see him coming off it? Only at his choice. It's like his choice to come off it. So I'm very cautious, but equally sometimes people call me a bit naive that, you know, I believe that everyone, if they turn around to me and said, I like to detox, I believe everyone has choice to decide that themselves. Yeah. That if they want to detox it, even if clinically I think they're going to find it difficult, I would still try and support them in that, but equally I'll have a plan in place that if they're struggling, that we can bring them back into a program again where they're more stable. So it's really much more, I let them make a lot of decisions, but I try and ensure that if I know that it's going to be difficult for them, that I at least have a plan in place that they're not going to suffer eventually or fall out of treatment, which is a real big issue, that they disappear and more harms are created by the fact that they disappear out of treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that trust is obviously a key thing, and kind of, yeah, taking your patients to be, you know, at face value and wanting to improve their lives, and that sort of trust then allows you to make a better decision amongst them. And that's kind of what you have to base all of these decision making structures on, really, I guess, right? One thing I wanted to kind of bring up.
Sorry, Dan.
Go ahead, Joanna.
I was just going to come in and say the trust really struck with me as well, because there's very few patients as a community pharmacist you see every single day. But your people who are coming in to you on substitution programs, you do tend to see every single day. Yeah. You know, if you are that pharmacist that's there all the time, and, you know, your whole team is so important as part of their care. It's not just you. It's that chatting and knowing, you know, who, what's going on in their life, you know, and checking their dog is okay and their pet is okay and their family are okay, because that's what's keeping them stable as well. You know, so it's a great privilege, you know, to be able to support people. But the trust is really important, and it has to be two ways. They have to trust you too, you know, so that they know that you're honest when you don't know the answer.
Yeah.
But you're going to see them again tomorrow, so you can go and find it out and get the answer for them, you know. So I think that relationship and that trust and developing it over time is really important, and trust also with your treatment centers that you're working with.
Yeah.
So that they know that you as a provider are coming back to them with concerns if you have it about service users, and keeping them in the loop. So there's, you know, and telling your service users that you do have to do that.
Yeah.
So they know that from the outset. So you set that agreement up, and it's a, you know, that agreement is set up very much so they know what to expect of you. Mm. You know what to expect of them. And they also know when you will act in their best interest. And that sometimes is going back to their prescriber and saying you have a concern, because you really are working in their best interest. Mm. And they'll know you do that, but you have to be honest about it.
Absolutely. And I know from my own experience, you know, there's been certain instances that I can think of where that's been, you know, exactly the case. And where, you know, at the time, the situations may have been quite tense. You know, the patient, and all of the instances that I can think of, will come back to you a period of time later, and they're doing well. They're appreciative of what you've done, because you have their well-being at the center of it. And that's fairly obvious in terms of, you know, I need to express this concern, not just because I have to, but because I want to make sure this is being flagged up. I don't want to put you at danger, you know. Yeah. And that could very easily happen, particularly if a patient maybe does, you know, take a step backwards. You know, you could potentially be contributing to that patient's harm. So being able to do that is certainly an important point. You know, I've had a number of patients who, you know, as you've said, Joanne, you know, you're one of those constants in their lives, and that you're seeing them in some instances 7 days a week. You're having a conversation with them, that it's someone where they can come and have a safe conversation with you, and can express concerns and can say, look, this is something that I'm worried about. Is this something we need to look at a little bit more? You know, and that source of advice is invaluable, I guess, in terms of supporting someone through, you know, that sort of situation, and hopefully onto the path to success, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I think, Dan, what you just said there is kind of the nub of everything. Sometimes you're the only person who asks them how they are.
Yeah.
The whole day. Hey, how are you doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that, I know we talk about these very fancy words like grief intervention, motivational interviewing, but hey, just asking a person how they are could be the trigger for anyone. So I think, as we've all said, that you see them most regularly, most often, and often that develops that trust and build up in trust.
Yeah, absolutely. And that trust, you know, tends to manifest itself in a range of different ways. I mean, I can think of a number of situations where, you know, patients have, you know, almost leaned on the pharmacy team as a source of people, someone to rely on and confide in a lot of instances. And again, I think that's the point too, which is, you know, a lot of individuals don't have that outside in their personal lives, and that's an important role that pharmacists and the teams can play in terms of supporting patients through what is a very difficult time. What I'm interested to talk a little bit about too is, you know, we've talked about what pharmacists can do more generally in terms of supporting patients through these, and it's something that Joanne had mentioned earlier on in terms of that sort of root cause maybe of this misuse of medicines as well, that could start from something sort of very innocuous, you know, from a treatment for pain that then becomes a little bit more chronic. And this kind of sidecars into a conversation that I had with somebody when I was talking to them about recording the podcast today. And the gist that I was getting from that conversation was around that substance misuse is more about getting a high from a medication rather than a dependence on a medication that you've maybe been taking for something that again has started out as being something innocuous. I'd be keen to hear both of your thoughts in terms of what you think and how pharmacists can play a role in preventing this becoming an issue in patients in those sorts of situations. You know, what pharmacists might be able to do from the outset when recommending these medicines, when maybe dispensing them to patients, when counseling them. What can we do to potentially prevent this from becoming a problem in certain patient instances in the first place?
Oh God, Dan, that's a very complicated question. What would I say? So me as a pharmacist still actively working in community pharmacy, what would I do with a script that comes in? So the first thing I do is check that they're, if somebody's coming in early on their substance, I will go out and talk to them and say, you know, Joanne, you're in a kind of week early for your meds. Are you sure you don't have some at home? Often you'll get the patient who might turn around and say, oh God, am I in early? Oh, that's fine, I'll wait till next week. But other times you get the patient kind of going, well, I had to take extra ones because it wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And then I would say to, usually then what I would try and suggest to the patient is that, have you spoken to your GP about this? You know, taking extra ones doesn't necessarily help with, you know, you sleeping more. It just makes you need more all the time rather than actually it helping you. So you might need to change what medication you're on. The whole thing is that often I go out, particularly with, so I know up north with Tramadol, down south it's slightly different. I might go out with Tramadol and say, do you actually need 2-3 times a day, 180 capsules this month? Or, you know, or will one box do you, or do you need any at all? Mm-hmm. So often I'll go out and ask that question. You often will find that people go, actually, I have loads of them at home, or, oh no, I need them. And I'll go, you know, how long have you been taking these? And, you know, you should really consider that you need them all this length of time. Sometimes as pharmacists, I think, and I don't know, Joanne and Dan, from your own perspective with practice up north, we tend to, I think, skirt around sometimes that issue rather than saying you have a problem because you're afraid of asking that question. Because then you're kind of going, if they turn around and say, yeah, I have a major problem, what the hell do I do next? Where do I refer them to? What's the referral pathway? Is there treatment for something like this? You know, where would I refer someone with just a benzodiazepine addiction? But we also know that they probably booze a little bit at the weekends. But, you know, is it alcohol or is it the benzo or is it both? Or where do I go with this? I'd only one person ever bring me into consultation room and get really upset, say, I have a problem here. I don't know what to do. Mm. I have to say I got quite upset because I had no idea what to do either. So it's often, for my perspective, is that we tend to skirt around the issue because we're unsure of what to do next. A lot of that will come down to, I think, experience in a pharmacy. And I don't know, Joanne, you might say it differently, but your experience and how long in the tooth you are, that you kind of figure out where people can go, or you have a contact of someone that you know that you can pick up a phone to. So I have a contact within, obviously, because working in the addiction services, I know a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I pick up the phone to people, I kind of go, I've such and such an issue here, where would I refer them to? So I had somebody who had a really interesting issue with prescription Ritalin and would not attend addiction services because that's for addicts. Did you not know that? I'm not an addict. And you're like kind of going, okay, I don't want to say you are because that's a really wrong thing to say to someone. Yeah. So trying to get them, they wanted to go for private services, and trying to get them through that system was actually quite complicated in the end. They got through the system, but they didn't appreciate what treatment was for that, which is virtually like a detox and end it. And I think that underlying all of this, there was probably a mental health condition that has been undiagnosed. I still think there's an undiagnosed one there that that I've advised them that they really need to see psych services about. Mm-hmm. Now, again, that's, I'm giving you kind of one examples off. For me, I've always found it challenging to kind of challenge the patient on their behavior. Like I don't know how it is for you, but down south sometimes you'll get a prescription and you know it's forged. Like you're kind of going, oh no. So what you'll do is, I know in the past when you're really tired in the pharmacy, you go, sorry, we don't have that in stock. really poor practice. Mm-hmm. I'll admit that myself. But you just have had a long day, and the last thing you need is somebody shouting you at 8 o'clock at night in a pharmacy, and all you want to do is just close and go home. Yeah. You kind of go, I'm sorry, we don't have that in stock. Maybe the other late night pharmacy might have it. What you'll do is you've taken a copy of it and you phone the next pharmacy saying this script is on its way to you. It's a definitive problem. Is that right or wrong? You're kind of pushing the problem on, but sometimes it really is your energy levels in pharmacy. And I'm sure it's the same in the north to the south. Pharmacists themselves were put under enormous strain during COVID. I still think we're traumatized by COVID. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're recovering as well as we should as professionals. I think that from my perspective as a practicing pharmacist and seeing my pharmacists, they're worn. That kind of thing, you're kind of going, it's easier just to pass it on. It's not the right answer, by the way. I'm saying we should challenge it, but then you're always worried that somebody will flip their lid and suddenly you have a different situation.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's not what you go to work for either. I don't know, Joanne, if I've gone around the house on that.
I agree. I suppose going back to Dan's question initially, it is about patient education and at that first prescription, making sure people are really clear that this is a medicine you've been prescribed. There's a genuine need for it this time. But what is the expectation about long-term use of this, and what do you need to be alert to? And if you're getting prescribed, you know, oxycodone or fentanyl or whatever it is, you know, that there is harm that can come from it, and the person needs to be alert to it. I suppose I absolutely get the bit about we pick our battles sometimes, you know, and the one I definitely am guilty of is the OTC, you know, the coding. There's a couple of pharmacies I work in, and I'm the person on the counter quite often when I'm working, and you're very, very good and very vigilant in that first couple of sales in the day. But when you're standing on a counter and maybe it's the 20th, the 50th time you've been asked for a particular brand of something, it is challenging to just have that conversation with the person. And, you know, but people are entitled to know, and people do need to know. And if you can have some sort of something else to educate the person, so whether it be in an alert card that you give them, mm-hmm. with the medicine, with the supply, that just very clearly lists the dangers. And quite often it is that when you ask people and you do challenge them, there's something else going on, and this is maybe just a sign of it. So and I absolutely agree, Dennis. It's having that confidence to say to the person, could there be an issue with how much you're using of this? Or I've noticed you've been in a lot and I'm worried about you, and I'm doing this from a good place, but it's knowing where to refer them to. And quite often that needs to be perhaps charities at times, you know, that you refer people to, and having an awareness as a community pharmacist, what's in your locality, what's available. And even if you don't know, if you have one person you can phone, you know, if you have one person in a charity that you can lift the phone and they'll direct you to somewhere else, and they'll say, it's not us, but it is, you know, people will never hang up the phone. People won't hang up. They'll get you somewhere else as a point of contact. But yeah, and people out there have challenging lives. You know, people have challenges. We have challenges. So obviously the general public have challenges. And sometimes it's just a call for a bit of help that we're always willing to give, you know. But I think, patient education is really critical in it too.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think just to echo what you both said in terms of that conversation can be difficult to have because you just simply don't know what the reaction is going to be. And, you know, I think, you know, to come back to what Dennis was alluding to as well, there are patients who are maybe aware, you know, subconsciously or otherwise, that there's a problem there. They maybe mm-hmm. aren't necessarily in a place to admit that yet. And sometimes having, you know, maybe think they're doing a good job of outwardly appearing that there's not a problem, and if then it becomes fairly clear that there's a problem that is noticeable by your pharmacist, and your pharmacist queries that, then that can lead to a less than savory interaction, and it's drumming up the courage and the effort and the energy. And also, Dennis, as you've really kind of clearly articulated, going to that sort of risk and not having anything to do off the back of it in terms of, well, okay, we've had that hard conversation, now we're in a position where we're ready to move on, what is the next step? And I think it's something that, you know, you tend to want to not sort of be looking at reactively and really look at proactively. And it's being aware of what services are out there and who to refer somebody on to in case you need to have one of those difficult conversations. And it's going to that extra mile, and it's maybe that good old CPD thing where you maybe do have a look at what's out there and keep that in the memory banks if those situations do kind of come along. I suppose in terms of that support, Dennis, as well, I mean, there's pharmacy there. In your opinion, you know, pharmacy does its thing. From your perspective, what other support is needed from healthcare more generally? You know, what other things, what things do we need out there that pharmacists could be referring people on to? What maybe exists in your sphere of practice that's been quite useful? What where do you think the gaps might be?
So I think that we probably need a better, well, we have improved our drugs education program. There's no doubt about it in both school setting and with students. I think that the HSE has been really proactive in the development of the drugs.ie website.
Okay.
Which has been a really, from my perspective, any pharmacist that phones me, I always tell them, hop onto the drugs.ie website. That will list kind of treatment options in locally, both charities and kind of statutory. And if you can't find anything, what I would tend to do is that in Ireland, we have, which was my previous role was a liaison pharmacist for opioid substitution treatment for every patient going into treatment. Mm-hmm. So Joanne as a pharmacist would, let's say she has a problem with Dan, the patient today, he can pick up the phone to Dennis and say, look, Dennis, I don't know what to do with Dan. He's really awkward at the moment. He's coming in. I've asked him to come in, you know, before we close at 6, he's arriving in at 6:02. We have the safe closed. I just find it a bit challenging. What do I need to do? So we would have, so they have that peer-to-peer support where the pharmacist would kind of, where I would say to Joanne, okay, so Joanne, when you originally drew up the contract with Dan, what was in it? Did you have a contract? Did you have an agreement? And sometimes you find that, oh, we didn't. So I said, so maybe you just need to go out and reiterate the importance that you need Dan to come in by 5:45. Maybe Dan is working and that's why he's late. Have you asked him that question? So often it's, in my previous role, I never told people what to do. I always let them kind of talk it out with me. And it became like almost like a, you know, what is it that you is your problem and what do you think might be their problem? And have you asked those questions? So from my perspective, there's a good support system if it's utilized by the pharmacist in question. Often the problem is that, you know, yourself, like somebody like a liaison pharmacist is going to be, you know, a 9:00, you know, not on call necessarily. So you need to also have that backup of the IT systems. And I think drugs.ie have definitively increased and improved their capacity for signposting people. We did a huge piece with pharmacists when they started doing needle exchange for us first about knowing your local service. And we did out leaflets for each of the local areas that they could hand to patients. You know, do you need your Hep B booster shot? Do you need to be tested for Hep C? Is there any other issues that are affecting you with regards, you know, coming into treatment? Do you want to come for treatment? Do you need treatment? So we did a lot of that with the needle exchange program. We even changed like product when we noted that the client group coming in weren't necessarily IVDUs. So we had a huge issue with tanning injectors. So the packs we were giving them were not appropriate. So they were getting like a pack for somebody who was cutting heroin with citric, et cetera, vitamin C. And we were giving that to tanning injectors who were using the vitamin C and burning themselves. So we modified our pack to suit their needs as tanning injectors. So we always looked to what was happening locally in the community in order to determine the service they got. For options of somebody who comes forward and says, I have a problem, I always direct pharmacists to contact their liaison pharmacist. And if they can't get hold of them, it's drugs.ie. Invariably, my own people within Lloyds will phone Dennis because Dennis will know someone who will know someone who will be able to organise. So a lot of it will come down to, you know, as Joanne said, you have kind of that person that you know that you pick up the phone and go, hey, I have a problem. Who is the best person to contact? So I have one or two of those people that I'll pick up and go, what's the services like at the moment over in, I don't know, in from in Monaghan, where's the best place to refer them to? Who's the best person that I can get them into treatment, or do they need to get into treatment? Is there somebody they can talk to as a local counselling service? So often it that referral pathway, it has improved with the fact that the IT systems have been put in place. Equally, COVID enhanced accessibility to treatment for patients. Our waiting lists decreased to zero, I would say, because we brought people into treatment as quickly as we could.
Right.
And hand in hand with that was that obviously you were afraid of giving people lots of takeaways at the time. So also that also expanded the use of naloxone for opioid overdose prevention. So it kind of worked. It was a positive thing in many ways that we were able to bring people into treatment much quicker once they came forward.
Yeah. And you've just preempted my next question, because it was around that naloxone project, Dennis, and it was something I'd read a little bit about, and it seemed really interesting. I was just wondering maybe if you could give us a little bit of an overview of that naloxone project that you were leading out on, and what that involved and what you found from it.
Okay, so I went to London in 2005 to go work with John Strang on overdose prevention and the use of naloxone. And in 2015, we managed to get our first naloxone. I hate the word pilot, by the way, because I always find pilots go nowhere. And as a project, you're always better calling them a demonstration, because then you're demonstrating it does work and has a success.
Sure.
So in 2015, we launched a demonstration project. But I know up north, it was you were ahead of us with regards to the provision of naloxone products. What we needed was a change in our law, which came about by SI 449, which allowed for the emergency administration of certain drugs in an emergency. And we put naloxone into that, which allowed us then to bring it forward. And it's like everything, once you have that government support and that push, it allows you to actually innovate much more rapidly and expand much more rapidly. So for us, we ran this demonstration project on a total amount of 2,000 euros at the time. I was given the budget to buy 600 products. And so obviously I chose my locations in conjunction with the other parties on our quality assurance group. So I set up a quality assurance group immediately, which involved both statutory and voluntary sector, to ensure that everyone had a say in how it would work. And for me, the most important people in all of this were actually people using drugs and their families and loved ones. Me, I was just like, I guess I like to say like a conductor in the background, kind of making things happen. But it wasn't me it was about. It was about making sure people didn't die is the bottom of it. And in our first, we only ran the demonstration project from June to September. And in that time, we had three uses of naloxone, which reversed the effects of an opioid intoxication. And for us, that clearly demonstrated that we were hitting the right cohort of individuals with this product, and equally that the availability of this product did save lives. So we roll on, and there's a lot of issues arise, and I'm not sure if it was the same up north for in Northern Ireland, was around insurances and how that looked with regards to training aspects. So in recent times, particularly in the past year, we've had huge movement forward with the naloxone. We've had huge movement around the provision of training and the recognition of institutions to have naloxone on site without prescription. That's what we're aiming for. Like I know up north in 2021, you have the police able to carry it. Certain police officers can carry naloxone. We're still pushing for that agenda forward, that agenda item forward. Here in the South, I think it is, people are a lot more open to it because they've seen the success in other jurisdictions. That's always really good. That the Gardaí here see that up in Northern Ireland. I think in the first week or two of it being available in Northern Ireland, they had three successful uses of it by police officers, which is a very positive thing. Mm-hmm. I know in the north of England and in Scotland, like positive stories around are very. So we're hoping that with slow steps forward. I always believe in taking little steps forward rather than giant leaps. And I know people give out to me that I'm very conservative in how I move things out, but I like to make sure that as you move it out, the risks aren't, you're not going to have a problem that there'll be a problem going forward. So from our perspective, we've had a huge transformation of the project in that it's moving forward much more rapidly because there's a buy-in from all the players. And I think that for me is a learning, regardless of what we're doing on Naloxone, but buying in all the players is probably the most important thing, because if you bring everyone on board, everyone has the same vision, everyone wants the same thing, and we all have the same vision. I'm not saying that we don't, we all do, but it's how we get to our end point, that at the end of the day, that the mother, father, brother, sister can access Naloxone and administer it as appropriate to their loved one. And I think that's ultimately where we want to end it. And for me, it's always important that at the end of the day, that the patient, and we've always been very coherent about this, I think, Joanne and yourself, Dan, that the patient is centered to care. So as long as we save a patient, that's the most important thing. And if Naloxone helps save people, and people argue back and forth, well, you don't know, Dennis, they could have spontaneous recovered. I don't know, but we know Sheila Bird did huge studies up in Scotland where she said 19 out of 20 can spontaneously recover, but there's 1 out of 20 that may not, and that Naloxone may work for that one person.
Exactly. And that's the impact that you need, right? Yeah. If it does save one person, then that's all it needs to do to justify the engagement into it. So yeah, it's things like that, I think, that are important. It's, you know, as you've said, it's I think that's a really good point about not saying piloting, because a pilot kind of infers that it might fail and it might not. And a demonstration of the value of something that, you know, obviously carries years of your expertise behind it is something that makes a lot more sense. And it obviously has shown a lot of value. I know that we've been chatting about things for a while now, and what I might do is kind of draw this conversation to a close, but I know, Dennis, we've only scratched the surface of your expertise and things that you've been leading out on. So it would be great to have you back on to the podcast at some stage soon to maybe talk about a few other topics that are related in certain ways and not in others. But to draw this particular conversation to a close, I was just wondering if there were, from both of you, from your experience and from things that you've done, it could be a resource to look at, it could be a piece of advice from your practice and your experience. If there was a pharmacist listening to the podcast today who has, you know, has heard everything that's been said, they're maybe kind of identifying a little bit of a need in terms of their learning and upskilling and ways that they can kind of practice in this area, what piece of advice, what resource, what would you give that individual as a starting point? Where would you tell them to kind of leap off into this in terms of improving their practice in this area? Dennis, I'll maybe start with you on that one in terms of that one nugget of sage advice.
Okay, so there's a number of courses run by our regulatory body, the IOP down south, and I'm sure it's a similar scenario up north, that will give you insights, and you'll have people who have work in addiction and will give those pieces of work of theory and practice. I do think it probably is a really good idea, and I've always believed that we've probably underutilized the resource that's there, is the EMCDDA, which is a fantastic website of information around drugs that are up and coming, emerging trends, kind of the what each country looks like from their drug use perspective, what services are offered in each country. I think that gives a huge amount of insight in and around Europe and different jurisdictions within the EU. The other website that I always find obviously really good is the Maudsley. From my perspective, I see it as a center of excellence. And they have some very interesting stuff. There was a really interesting study done, it must be 2 or 3 years ago now, even longer probably, because I'm getting old and I don't keep time, on chemsex in the Lambeth region in London, which was kind of the first onset of how to deal with this particular cohort of individuals with regards to their drug use. So they're very innovative from my perspective. And of course, like in the UK, you've got the NICE. You can't deny that. The NICE guidelines are absolutely amazing to start with for anyone to look at what best practice is. Down here, the drugs.ie has a huge plethora of information websites for people if they're interested in seeing and looking at various aspects of it, both from kind of your unusual cohort of people who use drugs up to, you know, your IBDUs and those who use heroin and those who maybe access needle exchange programs. There's a whole plethora of coursework there.
Great, thank you. Joanne, some sage advice from yourself?
Yeah, I suppose a couple of bits. So as Dennis said, you know, there's our training providers and our, you know, NICPLD here in the north run courses. And I know I particularly enjoy courses where there are some service users who participate and feed into those courses and use their own experiences. Another website I find very good in my practice is Choice in Medication. It's fed through our Northern Ireland Formulary website, and there are patient information leaflets there in a multitude of languages that can help with your practice, and you know you're getting it from a reputable source. But in there, there's leaflets that can help you explain in good language to patients about the differences in different antidepressants, in drugs of commonly used or misused as well. It helps you compare if people are asking about buprenorphine versus methadone and what are the positives or what are the negatives against them. So, and it's in very, I like things in plain English. So it's a good one. And I suppose the other one I would say is get a bit of shadowing. You know, if there's pharmacies in your locality or not in your locality, but you know of them who really have been supporting patients in this group for a long time, you know, get in and see if they'll give you a half a day just to go in and see, you know, or use their experience and their wisdom. And I suppose use the patients as well. Don't be afraid to ask, you know, because you know, you can always learn from our patients and learn to support them and what are their needs and find out and go from there. Yeah,
absolutely. Great stuff. Thank you for the both of you for those. I mean, what we'll try and do is provide as many of those links as we possibly can and the information that will accompany the podcast so that there is that jumping off point for somebody who does want to know a little bit more. You know, it brings us back to what we were talking about earlier on, where it's really all moving towards avoiding that situation of somebody maybe takes the first step with you as their pharmacist and you don't want to be in a position where you're not really sure what to do next and maybe how to move on to that next step. So for me, I think what I'm taking away from both of your words is have that preparedness, do what you can to have, you know, at least a next step or a next port of call, you know, to refer on to, and that can help that patient on a journey that will hopefully get them into a much better place, and that is invaluable. So we will do what we can to provide as much of that information along with the podcast and where we post it through our channels as well, and hopefully that will be a great starting point in addition to what you've both said during the podcast today. So I think at this point all that's really left for me to do is to say thank you very much to Dr. Dennis O'Driscoll and to Joanne Barry from Lloyd's Pharmacy and from the School of Pharmacy at Queen's respectively. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat to us about it. It is a really, really important topic and something that pharmacists are encountering more and more out there. So I appreciate your insight, your expertise and your experience on this one. We'll hopefully have you both back on the podcast again soon to chat about different topics and maybe to revisit some of the things that we talked about here as well. But for now, thanks again to both of you. Thanks to everybody that's been listening at home. And again, please do have a look at that additional information that we've provided along with the podcast in the hope that it will be valuable to you and a great starting point to learn a little bit more. So thanks very much to one and all once again. We'll hope to speak to everybody again listening at home on the podcast very soon. But for now, thanks very much.